From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Sunscreen, bug spray, deodorant. It's summer, and these products are flying off the shelves. They're also, it turns out, polluting our waterways. Researchers have found ingredients from pharmaceuticals and the products we use for personal hygiene in rivers and oceans, the Chesapeake Bay, even treated drinking water. They may be there in low concentrations, but they are everywhere.
We can find personal care product ingredients, pharmaceuticals, off the coast of Antarctica. Anywhere where we are, we're going to find these molecules in our water.
UMBC environmental engineer Lee Blaney explains how everything from antibiotics to shampoo enters our waterways and what that may mean for the health of aquatic organisms as well as human beings. What's in the water? It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Sunscreen, bug spray, deodorant. It's summer and products like these are flying off the shelves. They're also, it turns out, polluting our waterways. When we bathe, the many personal care products we use wash off our bodies, down the drain, and into the sewer system. But wastewater treatment plants aren't designed to filter them out. As a result, ingredients in everything from antibacterial soap to hair conditioner have been found in rivers, oceans, even treated drinking water. Lee Blaney, an assistant professor of environmental engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, studies these under-the-radar water pollutants, and he's joined us today to discuss his research. Welcome to On the Record.
Morning, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
Lee Blaney, a recent study of yours found that, quote, active ingredients in personal care products are ubiquitous in the environment, end quote. How common are they?
Yeah, it's a great question. So really, you know, these products that we use every day, they ultimately get into our water supply, and they end up wherever we are. So you can imagine there's a lot of people in North America and all of the other continents. One question that I always ask my students is I show a map with some recent studies that have found personal care products or pharmaceuticals in water systems. And I say, did I cover everything? I have all six continents where there's large populations. And they usually take a minute or two, and then they notice, well, there's nothing on Antarctica. And so they call that out, and I say, well, are there people in Antarctica? And they say, well, there's some. And sure enough, we can find personal care product ingredients, pharmaceuticals, off the coast of Antarctica. So again, anywhere where we are, we're going to find these molecules in our water.
Is the implication that the traces of these products stay pretty close to where people are? Are they in Antarctica because there are a few people there or because the waters took them there?
Mm-hmm. So some of them will transport further distances than others. These are mostly going to be the more hydrophilic, the water-loving chemicals. And some are going to stay around where they're discharged. They're going to get stuck in the sediment at the bottom of our waterways or our rivers or even the ocean. And those are going to be a little bit more hydrophobic. So they're more water-hating, which also means they like to accumulate in sediment, and so those don't transport as far.
Do we know what impact these substances are having on organisms that live in the waters?
That is a great question, and it's really an ongoing source of research. We've really kind of broken this down to start from a very reductionist standpoint. So can we just say we have relatively clean water and one chemical? Can we understand how that chemical degrades in that system? Now, can we complicate it a little bit more and maybe add in a matrix that looks more like wastewater and say, how does this chemical degrade in this system? What kind of toxicity does it cause in this system? And then can we start adding in other chemicals? And so the mixture question is quite difficult at this point. But I would say some of the concerns that are most worrisome are coming from antibiotics and antimicrobials. So the World Health Organization has actually stated that this century may be the last one where we have antibiotics that actually work. It actually takes longer for a new antibiotic to get onto the market these days than it does for resistance to that antibiotic to first appear.
And the chemicals you study are part of creating these resistant bacteria.
That's right. But there are other chemicals of concern. So some of the hormones that we use every day also make it into the water. So one example is the active ingredient in the birth control drug. And you can imagine a lot of women in the country use this molecule every day, and it ultimately makes its way into our water. Now, it's a very potent estrogen, and there's been some research showing that it can actually affect the reproductive systems of aquatic organisms. So one group showed that at very low levels that are pretty typical of what we see in the environment, this molecule can actually cause the feminization of male fish. So they're becoming more female-like. They're growing eggs in their testes. And as we start shifting the population demographics, you can imagine that as the male fish start going away, we're going to stop producing baby fish. And so it can actually cause the crash of these populations within the environment.
I seem to recall a lot of focus on that several years ago, fish like that found in the Potomac.
Yep, that's right.
It's an issue right around here.
Pretty much all around the world, we're seeing this in a number of different aquatic and marine animals.
But I want to loop back to where we started, because we started talking also about personal care products, sunscreen and bug repellent, and now we seem to be talking more about pharmaceuticals. Is that all part of the same picture?
So in my lab and my group, we study both pharmaceuticals as well as personal care products. And so we try to bin all of these chemicals, which we term contaminants of emerging concern.
Contaminants of emerging concern.
Exactly. So these are contaminants that may have been in our waterways for the last 3 decades or 4 decades or half a century, but it's really just been recently that we've started to be concerned about them some more. I will mention, in terms of personal care products, one that we're interested in increasingly these days are some of the sunscreen agents. And so this isn't necessarily just sunscreen products, but also cosmetics, makeups, lotions, anything that you put on your skin that has some UV protective ability. The main ingredients in those products were recently implicated in terms of coral reef bleaching. And so there's some evidence that these chemicals that we use every day to protect our skin and to protect our health can actually cause negative impacts on corals, which are a very important part of our ecosystem, play a very important role in our world. And this is at low concentrations, very low concentrations.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with UMBC environmental engineer Lee Blaney. He studies what happens when everyday personal care products like shampoo, soap, and lotion, as well as pharmaceuticals, enter our waterways. I understand ingredients from personal care products are found even in drinking water.
That's correct. There's not been as many of those studies as there have been within environmental systems like rivers or streams or even wastewater systems, but definitely the active ingredients of personal care products as well as pharmaceuticals and some of these other contaminants have been found in treated drinking water.
How worried should we be?
So again, you know, these contaminants are present at very low concentrations, oftentimes on the order of 1 to 10 nanograms per liter.
So like a drop in the ocean.
Pretty much 1 to 2 drops in like an Olympic-sized swimming pool is an analogy.
And I should be worried?
It's tough. You know, the toxicological research with some of these contaminants of emerging concern is still, I would say, in the preliminary phase. Over the last 10 to 15 years, we've done a lot of research to identify where they are in the environment, what concentrations they're present in the environment, including drinking water. But in terms of the toxicity, it's really complicated because we have mixtures of these chemicals, oftentimes at different ratios. And so it's just really a tough situation to say it's toxic or it's not toxic. But like the name contaminants of emerging concern implies, we have some concerns about these, and we think we need to do more research, especially on the toxicity side, I would say.
How do you even find contaminants that are that dilute? How do you even measure it?
So I think that's really where a lot of this research has come up in the last 10 to 15 years, as some of our analytical chemistry tools become more powerful and more sensitive. we're able to detect more and more compounds at lower and lower concentrations. So really, we first produced antibiotics in like the 1940s. Probably antibiotics have been present in our water since that time. But it's just until recently that we've had the tools powerful enough to be able to pick them up, detect them, and measure them. And so we use this kind of very advanced analytical chemistry to identify these, and increasingly we're trying to identify more and more. Because if you look at the number of FDA-approved drugs, and then you think about the FDA-approved active ingredients and personal care products, we're talking about thousands of molecules. Right now, the Safe Drinking Water Act only monitors and regulates about 100 chemicals.
So is the problem getting worse?
Probably the problem is getting worse. As the global population continues to develop, more and more people have access and the resources to buy different personal care products. And so per capita use of these products is increasing decade by decade. And so each person is now kind of consuming more of these molecules, which means for every person, more of them are getting into the wastewater system.
Do these substances move up and down the food chain or up the food chain?
Some of them can. So again, that comes back to the chemistry of individual contaminants. So some are what we call more hydrophobic, more lipophilic. And so that means that they kind of hate water and they love lipids or fat. And so if I have a fish, you know, that's swimming in a river that contains some of these chemicals, if those chemicals are more lipophilic, they can accumulate into the fat layer of the fish. And then you can imagine, you know, as the medium fish are eating the small fish and the large fish are eating the medium fish, they're consuming more and more of these chemicals that have been stored in the fat layers. So as we kind of move up the food chain, the larger organisms can be exposed to higher concentrations of some of these chemicals.
Of all the ingredients you study that make their way into the environment, which are the most worrisome?
From my opinion, I would say two of the classes that are most important or most concerning are antibiotics. So, you know, again, if we kind of think about some of the concerns with antimicrobial resistance, if we're no longer able to treat infections, if we start having superbugs being generated that we can't treat, this is going to be a concern for us moving forward, because how do we treat those people? How do we help those people? The second type of chemicals that I think are probably most concerning are what we call endocrine disrupting chemicals. And so these could be hormones, but these can also be some of those products like sunscreens that have some weak estrogenic capabilities. And so these molecules, they can accumulate pretty readily in aquatic organisms and marine organisms. And so as they're doing that, are we starting to see some of those reproductive disorders? Are we starting to see some of those endocrine disruption effects? Because that can have very critical consequences for ecological systems.
We talked about personal care products, things you put on your skin, wash off. How do pharmaceuticals get into the water supply?
So many of them we ingest. And then, you know, another thing that happens is people build up kind of stockpiles of pharmaceuticals, sometimes at home. They have an old bottle of medicine that's been sitting in the cabinet for a number of years. And so the two main ways that pharmaceuticals can get into our water is by flushing old medication down the toilet. I think in the past, doctors recommend it if you don't use your full dose of medicine, dump it down the toilet. You should not do that. You should just throw it in the trash. That's actually much more environmentally friendly. And then the other way is every drug that we take, every pill that we swallow, some of it gets excreted. So it doesn't get completely metabolized in our bodies, which means some fraction is getting peed into the toilet and going downstream to the wastewater treatment plant, where, as you mentioned before, they're not fully removed and they ultimately make their way into the environment.
I want to pick up on that in a minute. We need to take a quick break here. We're with UMBC environmental engineer Lee Blaney talking about the effect of personal care products and pharmaceuticals in our water supply. More about that when we come back. I'm Sheila Cast. This is On the Record. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about personal care products and their role as water pollutants. The ingredients and compounds from perfume to insect repellent have been found in rivers, lakes, oceans around the world. My guest, UMBC environmental engineer Lee Blaney, studies these everyday pollutants. Lee Blaney, you wrote an article this spring for the online magazine The Conversation, in which you noted that wastewater treatment plants are not designed to treat, quote, the thousands of specialty chemicals in pharmaceuticals and personal care products, end quote. How hard would it be to design a plant that could deal with all these chemicals?
So really it comes down to regulation. Municipalities, cities, towns, they could build plants that would do a better job at removing some of these chemicals. But the problem really is, in my opinion, that they're not regulated right now by either state agencies or federal agencies. And so without regulation, it's a large cost for treatment plants to add a new system, maintain a new system, hire the personnel to take care of that system. And so really, if there's not that regulatory pressure, that if you're not doing a good job treating, we're going to fine you, it's hard for municipalities to kind of put up the costs to actually treat these chemicals.
What kind of cost factor are we talking about to be able to treat them?
I don't have the answer to that in economic terms, but one thing that is kind of helping this situation to some extent is the issue of water scarcity. Throughout the south of the country, the west of the country, municipalities are increasingly dealing with water scarcity. And so they have to move to alternative water resources. This is like if we were using a river, but now we have a much higher population and there's not enough water in that river for us to use, what else can we do? And so some places are moving to desalination. So can we use seawater? Can we take the salt out and drink that? And some places are actually saying, well, can we take wastewater effluent, you know, wastewater that's been treated, actually treat it a little bit further and turn that back into drinking water within the same municipality? And so some places are doing that in California and throughout the south of the country just because of water scarcity. They probably have a better sense of the economics, but I think the point I'm trying to make is really that we can do this and we are doing this, and that water scarcity or availability and water quality are really intimately linked.
But if I'm following correctly, that might protect humans who use that system, but the aquatic animals would still be floating around in water that's not free of these chemicals we're talking about.
It could be, but I think the more we close the loop between wastewater and drinking water, so now if that wastewater or a significant portion of it is kind of being kept for later use as drinking water, that means that we're sending less of it downstream with these chemicals. And these plants usually operate with advanced systems that are very good at treating some of these organic molecules like the antibiotics, the hormones, the sunscreens that we've been talking about. And so there is an opportunity to both lessen our impacts on the environment without really sacrificing anything in terms of our quality of life.
That's UMBC environmental engineer Lee Blaney here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his work studying personal care products and their role as water pollutants. Some of your research is in local waterways. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, this work has been going on all around the world, but we think it's really important for us at UMBC to also be looking at our own backyard. And so a couple of years ago, we started a project with the USDA Forest Service to look at the presence of some of these pharmaceuticals and personal care products in the Gwens Falls watershed, which runs from Baltimore County down through Baltimore City and ultimately discharges into the bay. And so we went out and we collected samples and we measured for a suite of antibiotics, hormones, and then sunscreen agents. And one thing that we were a little bit surprised at is we found a diversity of antibiotics as well as the other molecules in most of the samples that we analyzed.
Most of the samples?
Most of the samples. And so we kind of started scratching our heads because there's no wastewater treatment plant that discharges into the Gwens Falls. There's no major animal feeding operations, which are the largest consumer of antibiotics. And so we started scratching our heads and saying, well, where are they coming from? Because it's not immediately clear. And so our hypothesis right now is that they're actually coming from leaking sewers. And we just got a new project award to study this a little bit further and see, can we actually use some of these contaminants of emerging concern as tracers to help locate where sewers are leaking so that we can then go in, fix those sewers, replace those sewers, and both protect the local environment from traditional contaminants, but then also some of these emerging ones as well.
And you've also been collecting data on oysters in Chesapeake Bay.
That's right. You know, one of the things that's really important to us is looking at the Chesapeake Bay. You know, and this is the largest estuary in the country, very important part of Maryland. And so we wanted to go out and say, okay, there's a lot of people that live in Maryland that live upstream in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. Those people are using pharmaceuticals, they're using personal care products. To what extent are these molecules persisting as they get into the environment, especially such a large body of water as the Chesapeake Bay? And to me, I actually find it very interesting because on the western shore of the bay, you have large urban centers, you know, Washington, D.C., Annapolis, Baltimore. And on the eastern shore, you have a lot of agricultural operations, which use different pharmaceuticals, and maybe we see different personal care products as well. One of the ideas is, can we actually map the bay and identify which pharmaceuticals, which personal care products are present in the water, in the sediment, and in oyster tissue to get a better sense of how land use can kind of be picked up by these emerging water quality tools.
And you found some of these personal care product ingredients in local crayfish?
Yeah. So
from what rivers?
In the Gwens Falls watershed, one of the things that we did with the USDA Forest Service was, in addition to looking at water and sediment samples, we went out and we collected crayfish. And so the idea there was, crayfish live in streams, especially small streams, all throughout North America. And so can we actually use these as almost biomonitors? So if some of these lipophilic chemicals accumulate in crayfish tissue, can we actually analyze that tissue to get a better sense of the long-term exposure of different aquatic invertebrates as well as vertebrates in these smaller streams? And so we went out to a number of sites in the Gwens Falls and we collected crayfish, came back to the lab, we dissected them, analyzed them. We just looked at the tail tissue, but what we found that was very interesting to us is we found the birth control drug that I mentioned earlier. We also found a number of sunscreen agents. We think it's really serious and we think it's kind of concerning that these molecules that we use for very specific purposes are accumulating in wildlife because we just don't know the consequences.
What advice do you have then for listeners who want to avoid being part of the problem?
I think the first thing is to just get informed. I remember one thing that I used to do when I was spending time in the bathroom is read the backs of all the products, you know, around the tub or on the back of the toilet. And just kind of saying, okay, what are all these organic chemicals that are present in my shampoo or my conditioner? What are these chemicals and what do they do? Why are they in there? And so I think just kind of increasing that scientific literacy is important.
Well, when you've increased your scientific literacy by reading the ingredient list on the products, what does that lead you to decide? Are there some chemicals you should run from and say, I'm never going to buy shampoo with whatever in it? Where does that lead you?
Well, I think where it leads is first to ask more questions and then ultimately make decisions. So that might be personal decisions about what products to use based on what active ingredients are present. And so one example is thinking about the sunscreens. So like I said, there's been increasing evidence in the last 2 or 3 years that some of the chemicals in sunscreens can cause toxicity to corals. And so there's actually now labels called reef safe or coral safe on different sunscreen products. As we're increasing scientific literacy, as people are asking more and more questions about what products they use and the chemicals in those products, we're generating more choices for consumers. Those choices also need to be vetted, but I think it's a start because once we're kind of generating that interest in using products that are maybe more ecologically friendly, then we're kind of increasing that pressure to look at building new regulations to handle these compounds in wastewater treatment plants, or maybe in the production of new products themselves. And so I think it really has to start with people and then ultimately move towards regulation.
But it's not as straightforward as looking for an organic label, for example.
At this point, I don't think so. But I'm hoping that we'll be able to move in that direction.
I really appreciate
you're telling us about your research. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Lee Blaney is an assistant professor of environmental engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We have a link to his article in the online magazine, The Conversation, at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.